Now, Kenosha County District Attorney Michael Gravely announced earlier this week that the police officer who shot Jacob Blake in August will not face charges. Blake was shot 7 times and was partially paralyzed. Gravely said he didn't think he could prove that the officer, Rustin Chesky, wasn't acting in self-defense. The shooting sparked days of protests in Kenosha this summer over the use of police force against Black Americans. Blake's family members said they disagreed with this week's decision and are considering civil action in the near future. Filing charges against officers is rare. Our next guest has followed the issue for years and created one of the country's most comprehensive databases on officer-involved shootings and other arrests. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the decision not to file charges in Jacob Blake's shooting? What questions do you have about officer-involved shootings in general? And when police are and are not charged with crimes, do you think we need changes in police accountability? If you work or have worked in law enforcement, what is your take? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Philip Stinson is a professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University and the author of the book Criminology Explains Police Violence. He is a former police officer and attorney. He created one of the country's most comprehensive data sets on police crime. Phil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, Rob, it's good to be with you.
Well, on Tuesday, as I said, the Kenosha County DA announced he wouldn't pursue charges in the Jacob Blake shooting. Let's take a brief listen.
It is my decision now that I announce today before you that no Kenosha law enforcement officer in this case will be charged with any criminal offense based on the facts and the laws.
That was a little bit of a much longer presentation. Phil, first of all, in this specific case, what was your reaction to that decision?
Well, I had to really sit down and read the whole report that the district attorney prepared. It's a 40-some page report with another 40 or 50 pages of exhibits. And you get a really different sense of things of exactly what happened than I got when I originally had watched the video that was released many months ago, which was just horrific and horrifying to watch an officer shoot a man in the back at point blank range. Just horrifying. But when you look at all the facts that the officers had when they arrived on the scene that day in August, you know, things are a little bit different here. And I think we have to really look at the situation a lot closer as to why the decision was made not to charge the officers. In other words, a finding that the officers were legally justified or that the officer was legally justified in using deadly force.
Can you talk about what goes into a decision like that? And in some cases, it might not be the DA thinks this is the right decision to pull the trigger or not, but what could be proven in a court of law, what the validity of the self-defense defense might be. Talk about some of the factors that go into a charging decision.
Well, the district attorney's report goes into great detail on the law of self-defense in the state of Wisconsin. But as a general rule, a police officer is justified in using deadly force if the officer has a reasonable apprehension of an imminent threat of serious bodily injury or death being imposed against the officer or someone else. And the U.S. Supreme Court has clarified that that's a standard of objective reasonableness. It's, in other words, it's what a reasonable police officer in that situation without the benefit of hindsight would have perceived at that instant when the shooting took place as to whether it was justified or not. So if an officer's subjective belief is objectively unreasonable, then that officer would not be legally justified in using deadly force. So what we have here is a situation where quite simply, you know, it's the district attorney's position that a reasonable police officer could have or would have perceived such a threat in that instance. And it's very fact specific. It's because of the facts of this case that are detailed in the district attorney's report as to why the district attorney drew that conclusion. Now, as to your question as to the charging decision and things that go into it, oftentimes prosecutors look at, you know, the likelihood of getting a conviction. In fact, there's an ethical rule that deals with that. They obviously have to have probable cause to bring charges, but they also have to have a good faith belief, a reasonable belief that they could obtain a conviction. So they have a downward look here to decide, is this something they want to go forward with? And frankly, some of these cases are very difficult. And in some instances, prosecutors have made the decision to go forward and bring charges, saying at the time they bring charges, we know this is going to be difficult to do, but our job as a prosecutor is to seek justice, and we're going to let the jury be the trier of fact, and we'll have a trial. And that's not what happened in this situation, though.
How often in officer-involved shootings do charges end up being filed? And when charges are filed, how often does that result in a conviction?
Well, we really don't have a whole lot of data in this area. And in terms of the number of on-duty shootings across the country where an officer shoots and kills someone each year, the best data we have is only from 2015, and that's data from the Washington Post. And we now know that on average, about 1,000 times each year, on-duty police officers shoot and kill someone. And I can tell you from my own research, since 2005, only 127 officers across the country, so non-federal sworn law enforcement officers, so that would be police officers, sheriff's deputies, state troopers, game wardens, only 127 officers have been charged since 2005. And to date, I think only 44 of those officers have been convicted. So about 30 of the cases are still pending, and I think 54 of the officers or so, or 52 of the officers, their cases ended in a non-conviction, and that could be for a variety of reasons. So out of 1,000 times each year, we saw 15 officers who were charged last year in 2020. The year before that, we only saw 12 officers. And then as I look back in my data since 2005, we actually see the number of officers charged. It's actually anywhere from just one officer charged, which was in 2011, to a high of 18 officers charged in 2015. So in every year, it's been fewer than 20 officers charged with murder or manslaughter resulting from an on-duty shooting across the country since 2005. And the reason for that is because in most instances of on-duty fatal shootings by sworn law enforcement officers, there's a determination made that the officer was legally justified in using deadly force.
We're talking to Philip Stinson from Bowling Green State University, author of the book Criminology Explains Police Violence, looking at the decision in Kenosha to not charge the officer and the officers involved in the shooting of Jacob Blake, and wider issues of police accountability when officers are and aren't charged. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in La Crosse. Mark, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, yes, Mark?
I wanted to first say my hat is off to all law enforcement out there across this great nation. I think that they face a lot of stressful situations that most people don't want to be in to begin with. When they're walking into a domestic dispute or to a drunk driving thing or to whatever it is, responding to a call, and they're going into a hot zone. And their lives are at stake. They want to go home at night, see their loved ones and everything like that, just like everybody else does. And I think as a society, we have lost respect for law enforcement individuals. If you are a law-abiding citizen in this country to begin with, and you are not doing something wrong, and a police officer stops you or talks to you, and the first thing your reaction is to do is run or get aggressive or get verbally abusive or anything like that, that is intolerable in this country. Police officers are there to protect and serve the vast majority of them and to do their jobs honorably. And if they have to use lethal force, I'm all in for, if an officer tells you to stop, put your hands in the air and drop whatever is in your hands, and you do not do that, and they can't identify what is in your hands, to me, that now becomes, whether it's a rock or a glass bottle.
I think we got you, Mark. I want to bring Phil in on this now. Mark, expressing, I think, a commonly held point of view. What do you think, Phil?
I think that's true, and Mark raises some good points. I think that, I come at this with, sitting here as a 56-year-old white male professor, with tenure at a state university in Ohio. So many people have different experiences, though. I talk to people all across the country on a regular basis, many Black individuals who share with me stories of very different experiences with law enforcement officers than the ones that I've had. And I think that we have to be cognizant of that there are people of all walks of life who have very different experiences and encounters with law enforcement officers. But his points are well taken.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Phil Stinson right now, professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University, looking at why police officers seldom face charges for fatal shootings, coming after the Kenosha County District Attorney said he would not be filing charges in the August shooting of Jacob Blake. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reaction to that decision. Your questions about police accountability in general, our guest knows a lot about the topic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, take more of your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Phil Stinson, professor of criminal justice at Bowling Green State University, looking at when police officers can be charged in fatal shootings, coming after this week's decision in Kenosha to not charge officers involved in the shooting of Jacob Blake. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. James is with us in Milwaukee. James, hi.
How are you? I'd like to say that I think I have a way to stop all these shootings overnight, and that's insurance bonds. Every police officer in the country should be covered by insurance bonds. Now, most people have never heard of insurance bonds, and I'll take a moment to explain it. Let's take your car insurance. You have car insurance. You pay it on a monthly basis. You have an accident. You make a claim. Well, on an insurance bond for a police officer, there should never be a claim, because once a claim is made, that police officer is on the hook, and that police officer cannot do anything unless that bond is paid. So I think that would stop it overnight.
James, thanks for the call. I've seen this idea floated, Phil. I'm not sure exactly how it would work or if it would work. Do you have thoughts on that idea?
Actually, I've not heard of the issue of insurance bonds, as James mentioned in that context. But, you know, a related matter is the doctrine of qualified immunity. And that comes into play when officers are named as defendants in federal civil rights lawsuits. And the idea behind qualified immunity is that officers are immune from money judgments if the court holds a qualified immunity in place for a case. But I'm not sure that getting rid of qualified immunity is going to solve a whole lot because and by the way, in my research, we've discovered that the police officers are sued far more often than you might imagine across the country in federal courts and in local courts as well. But many police officers, quite frankly, are judgment proof, and that civil defense attorneys are interested if they're suing for money damages, they're interested in the deep pockets of the municipality or their insurance carriers. So, James, you raise a good point, though, with insurance bonds. That's something I'd need to take a closer look at.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Cindy with us now in Appleton. Cindy, hello.
Hello. Well, you know, I wouldn't have such a problem with these kind of issues, except that it seemed to be predominantly happening to Black people. And you had that 17-year-old in Kenosha that shot two people during those riots, walking up and down the street with a lethal weapon, which he had actually discharged, and nobody even said boo to him. So I don't know how somebody like your last caller can think that, not the last caller, but a couple callers ago, that it's all right to just shoot somebody if they look like they're not, you know, doing something right. And here you have this young man walking up and down the street. He shouldn't even have a gun, and he gets nothing. So my problem with this is it's predominantly the Black people that it happens to.
Cindy, thanks for the call. What do we know about the racial makeup, Phil, of people who are shot by police officers?
Well, we really still don't have enough data that we can actually really answer that question in a quantitative way. But I can tell you from my own research, it does seem that many police officers have a fear of Black people, and specifically Black men and boys. And by the way, when we look at the cases where officers are arrested and charged with murder or manslaughter for having shot a Black woman, every one of those cases, the woman was shot in or at her own home, which really is an interesting issue. But I think we have to deal with, you know, that you can't deal with anything in the criminal justice system without looking at race and racism. And we frame it in the context of institutional racism. And I'd just like to to get it out there that it's at even a more base level. It's that there's a fear of Black people that is pronounced in many of the more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the country. And I don't know that we can fix this with a few hours of implicit bias training. We have to really hit this issue head on. And I don't know how we do that. But the first step is recognizing that it's a problem.
Thanks for that call. You've mentioned a couple times, and I've heard this from other people who work in criminology, that we don't have great data on police shootings. We collect a lot of data in this country. Why do we have this sort of blind spot?
Well, I think it's because historically it's not been something that the U.S. Department of Justice has been interested in. It's not been something that they've cared to take a look at. It's only been a handful of criminologists and journalists, frankly, across the country who've taken a very close look at it. And it's very difficult to track data. So, you know, I study police crime. So I study cases where police officers are arrested for crimes. And I've done that, as I said earlier, since 2005. And much of my data is publicly available in a searchable database. It's called the Henry A. Wallace Police Crime Database. And you can find it on the internet at policecrime.bgsu.edu. And the reason I got into that research as a graduate student, I'd been a police officer, I'd been an attorney, and I went back to school and was a graduate student. And I realized about 16, 17 years ago that the government simply did not track instances where officers were charged with crimes for anything. And they certainly didn't track any data at that time that was very useful on police shootings. So it's something that in recent years, the Justice Department has tried to get a handle on. They've started more data collection, but it's voluntary at these more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies. And we'll see how they do in this latest round.
We are talking to Phil Stinson from Bowling Green State University in Ohio. He is a criminal justice professor there, former police officer and attorney, looking at when police get charged for crimes, when they're charged for fatal shootings. Back to your calls. Steve is with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Oh, hi. Yes, I'm not buying the shooting in the back of somebody is okay ever. I mean, where's the taser? And apparently if the taser was ineffective, well, that must have been a bad shot. Sorry, that's on them. This is all on the police. Get it straight. The police are accountable for this.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Steve, referring to the Jacob Blake case where a taser, I think, was used twice before the shooting there. But Phil, Steve making the case that police in this case and maybe others, he thinks too quick to resort to lethal force.
No, Steve raises a good point. You know, when I was a young police officer about 35 years ago now, you know, it was right after the Supreme Court issued its opinion in Tennessee versus Garner. And I thought at that time, as a 21-year-old police officer, that that was the last time that a Black adolescent male was going to be shot in the back by a police officer in this country. And we now know that it happens frightfully often, quite frankly. And I share Steve's concern. And that's why I was concerned with the initial video. But there are a lot more facts here. But you do wonder if officers could simply have tackled him and disarmed him with a knife that Mr. Blake had and kept him from getting in the car. But I don't want to second guess the actions of the officers. But I am with Steve that it's very troubling when we see Black males shot in the back by police officers. It frankly shouldn't be happening.
Thanks for the call. Phil, have you compared and contrasted U.S. Police behavior with that in other comparable countries around the world? How do we stack up? Are there lessons to be learned?
Well, I don't know that we have good data in this area either in terms of a comparative analysis, and I haven't looked at that closely, but I assume that we have far more shootings in this country than in many comparable developed countries around the world, but we just don't have good data on that.
Let's bring on another caller. Patrick is with us now in Milwaukee. Patrick, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to respond to some of the comments that the first caller made, which was a very tired notion that somehow if people just responded to police respectfully and submissively, that then they wouldn't get shot. That if they're not breaking the law, they wouldn't put themselves in a position to be shot and killed. And this is just untenable. If you look at a case like, say, Breonna Taylor's, she was in bed sleeping, and there's dispute, of course, whether or not the police identified themselves, but neither she nor her boyfriend had been convicted of any crimes at this point. She wasn't doing anything illegal, and yet she died because of police excessive force. I have to put that out in counterpoint. My question for the guest is about your research, because the first caller's idea that, you know, obeying the law keeps you from getting shot is on the face of it silly, but it also ignores research like yours, which might point out, because it doesn't explain.
Okay, Patrick, we just have a few moments left. No time for your question, but Phil, do you want to respond to Patrick's first point there?
Well, I think Patrick is right. I mean, you know, we have a problem in the past that the police have always owned the narrative in these situations, and bystanders' accounts have not been taken seriously. And what we've seen with technology, with bystanders, with citizens having a smartphone video recording capability, with body cameras, with dash cams, with security cams, that we're starting to get alternative narratives. And in instances where the factual narratives of the police are inconsistent with the video evidence, that's very helpful to prosecutors in trying to figure out what happened in these situations and whether charges are appropriate.
Phil, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Philip Stinson, professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green. His research tracks data on officer-involved shootings as well as criminal charges against police officers. He joined us for a look at the decision not to charge a Kenosha police officer in the shooting of Jacob Blake and why criminal charges in officer-involved shootings are uncommon.